I am here with David French. David, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks so much for having me back. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to see you. I'm a big fan of your writing. Remind people where they can read you online.
New York Times. I have a newsletter and a column every week at the Times, and then also podcast pretty regularly. So just go to the New York Times and there I'll be.
Do you publish anywhere else or are you exclusive to the Times now?
All my written work is at the Times. Okay. I'm also on I have a podcast called Advisory Opinions that I do with Sarah Isker, and that is covering the law and the Constitution, basically exclusively with a little bit of free like dating advice for lawyers sprinkled in there as well.
Right. Well, we're not going to cover the dating advice, but we will talk about the law a little bit. Let's start with the sort of your big picture experience of the last seven some odd months. How has the second Trump term struck you?
I would classify it as an assault on our Republican form of government, is one way to put it. If you're thinking about the American system and the American form of government, one of the things that's really important is you sort of break down the two foundings of America, the first founding, running from 1776 and the Declaration through the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And then the second founding is the Civil War and the Civil War amendments. The fundamental aim of the first founding was establishing this Republican form of government. No monarchs, no centralized power under one person. This is really fundamentally the entire object of that first founding, is establishing this Republican form of government. And what we've seen is, in the last 7 months, is what we've seen is an escalating attack on that Republican form of government. And this is something that's been happening for a while in the sense that the presidency has continued to just accumulate more and more power over time. But it has now gotten to a point where that process is accelerating out of control. And we're now seeing sort of a, not just presidents accruing power sort of as part of a incremental process, but now grabbing power. President Trump is grabbing power with both arms in a way that is supported by particular MAGA legal theories and directly contradictory to not just the letter of the Constitution, but the entire spirit of the constitutional project. So other than that, things are going great.
Yeah. Well, before we get into more of what concerns you about Trump and Trumpism and this assault upon our form of government, remind people about your political biases, such as they are, because I mean, one of the reasons why I love talking to someone like yourself is that any allegation of partisanship just simply doesn't run through. So how do you describe yourself politically?
Well, I had been a lifelong Republican. So I was born in 69, came of age politically during the Reagan presidency, would have long considered myself a Reagan conservative. So I was a delegate to the Republican National Convention in 2012, supporting Mitt Romney, for example. I was a member of the conservative legal movement. I was the former president of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. I worked for conservative public interest legal organizations. FIRE is not conservative, it's nonpartisan. But after I was at FIRE, I worked for conservative public interest legal organizations. I'm a former Army JAG officer, served in Iraq during the surge. And right until the rise of Trump, I would have proudly called myself a Republican, definitely called myself conservative, still call myself conservative, but no longer call myself Republican.
Right. So what is the worst thing so far that has happened? It doesn't have to be one thing. It just what comes to mind when I ask you kind of where the bright lines are. I mean, one of the things that's most mystifying to me is to find myself in conversation with a smart person or an ostensibly smart person who simply doesn't see anything that has happened that shatters any kind of norm that should have been inviolate. Or, I mean, just like there's this kind of slow creep where more and more becomes permissible. There's just too much to pay attention to. We just can't follow the plot anymore. As in Bannon's terms, the zone has been flooded fully with shit. And that turns out to be so effective that you talk to people who really have nothing on their list of things that seem so far out of the ordinary as to be disqualifying for this president or the political movement behind him. What's clearly crossed the line for you in the second term?
Yeah, There's a few things, but the one that really stands out to me, and it's not going to be one incident, but it's the cumulative effect of a number of incidents, and that is the distortion of our system of federal justice. So the distortion of the Department of Justice into an instrument that is being stocked increasingly with Trumpist partisans, the explicit targeting, public explicit targeting of political enemies for potential criminal investigations, or in some cases, maybe actual investigations. We can talk about the Bolton search, for example. I'm withholding judgment on the underlying merits. I've not seen the search warrant, for example. I don't know some of the underlying facts, but I do know that the run-up to the search warrant and the conduct of the administration after the search warrant absolutely transgresses prior DOJ practices. The firing of prosecutors of the Jack Smith prosecution team, the pardoning of the January 6th rioters, all of these things together very clearly indicate that there is a two-tiered system of justice, that Trump's allies receive mercy, Trump's allies will even receive pardons, and Trump's enemies, at the very least, are going to be subjected to the most heightened and exacting scrutiny. And at the worst, even innocent people will feel the brunt of the law under this administration. And this is the kind of system of justice that is far more reminiscent of monarchies or autocracies, where you have the monarch, the single figure, where their will, their desire is what justice is. And so I would say the attack on the Department of Justice followed very closely behind something that is not as much in the headlines, but is the systematic purge we're seeing in the Department of Defense as well. Both of those are very much related. They have similar impulses. They have similar outcomes, but the DOJ process, the Department of Justice process, is sort of further down the road.
Yeah, this selection for loyalty above all, right? Just purging the various branches of government of anyone who, you know, has a history of having criticized him, or given that history, hasn't made sufficiently obsequious amends. I mean, because obviously there are people in his orbit who did criticize him, like his vice president. But I think if you bent the knee enough and low enough in supplication, he's a fan of that as well. So, but this using loyalty as the test, it produces many outcomes which are undesirable, but one is that it selects for people who are not ethical almost by definition. I mean, selecting for people who are willing to pass some humiliating loyalty tests where they have to pretend to believe things that they obviously can't believe because they're preposterous, and are willing to say those things in public, right? And willing to, I mean, the kinds of proclamations you hear from Pam Bondi or Kash Patel. I mean, some of the things they said in the aftermath of the raid on Bolton, which we'll talk about. Again, I don't know the details of the case, but the way Bondi and Patel spoke publicly on social media around that just sounded like it's the language you expect from a tyranny. I mean, this is not the way our politics used to look.
Well, you know, it was sometimes frustrating prior to Trump that there is this DOJ practice that we're not going to confirm the existence of investigations. This was the general matter. And there's a very good reason for that. And the reason is that when people know that someone is subject to a criminal investigation, they often skip straight to guilt, that the existence of a criminal investigation is somehow proof of criminal wrongdoing. And if somebody's investigated and not charged, a fair society, a fair country doesn't want that cloud hanging over them. And so even this notion that a Kash Patel is going to go on Twitter while the search is ongoing, or even while it just ended, and spike the football over it, no one is above the law. When you talk about J.D. Vance going on television and confirming investigations of Ambassador Bolton, when you see the president of the United States calling for vengeance against his enemies, you see administration officials advertising that they want to do mortgage fraud investigations of some of their political opponents. When you see all of that, it reminds you of why some of these rules exist, that some of these rules and norms and practices exist because, specifically, we do not want innocent people to face clouds of suspicion. Mm-hmm. And once the cloud lands firmly through, say, an indictment, then that person has an opportunity to defend themselves. Very limited opportunity to truly defend themselves if they're just subject to an investigation. And that's just like one piece of all of this, where where barrier after barrier after barrier has been just blown through in such a way that it's very satisfying to his core constituency because they wanted this. This is exactly what they wanted. But for everyone else, for his opponents, it creates a sense that there's a target on your back. And for the rest of America, it casts aspersions on people who may be entirely innocent of any wrongdoing, but the bully pulpit has been turned against them and their reputation could be stained forever, for just forever, yeah, without any kind of judicial proceeding.
And even if their reputation isn't stained, because even if anyone who looks at the case knows that it was, you know, spurious and vindictive and not, and shouldn't have been launched in the first place, they can be bankrupted by the obligation to defend themselves.
I mean, it's life deranging punishment. Yeah.
Yeah. However spurious it is. I'm thinking of someone like Chris Krebs, who was the election security officer who, you know, simply wouldn't agree that the 2020 election had been stolen. And now he's been investigated for, you know, what indiscretion I've forgotten. But the real indiscretion is that he simply wouldn't sing the president's tune at the time. Well, so there's two sides to this monstrous object. There's the favor to friends and the vindictive vengeance against enemies or perceived enemies. Let's take the friend piece of it. You mentioned pardoning the January 6th rioters. Why was that as sinister as you think, and not just a difference of opinion about, you know, that too much had been made of a protest that just got out of hand, right? This is just not, no one was trying to do anything of substance. They just got a little agitated, and then you know, we've seen video on Tucker Carlson's impeccable program of cops letting other people in the, you know, at least one side of the building. So it wasn't all flagpoles stuck into the faces of cops. Sometimes the cops just let people in. So this is a morally ambiguous situation. Why isn't this just, you know, clemency and a sign of just how capacious the goodwill of the current president is?
You've convinced me, Sam. That's what it is.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. No. Let's go back a bit and talk about when the pardon power was put in the original 1787 Constitution. This was something that was controversial at the time. And so you'll even go back and you'll read some of the ratification debates in Virginia, most notably, where George Mason stands up and strongly objects to the powers of the presidency, including the pardon power. And the concern there was that the president would use the pardon power to assist his friends, to grant friends and suspicious characters would be a phrase that would be used, a kind of an impunity, that the president would use the pardon power for his own self-interest, and that the how capacious the pardon power was, it's unreviewable, it's totally at the president's own discretion, it's not limited by its any real terms in the Constitution, that this would become an engine of political favoritism. This is something that has been worried about for more than 200 years. And so the answer to this was that the pardon power in many ways was supposed to be, and a lot of criminal justice reformers will defend the pardon power and say, well, wait, hold on. The pardon power allows for sort of last-ditch interventions of mercy when the judicial system has created a miscarriage of justice. And the judicial system, we have exhausted the judicial system, but the miscarriage of justice remains. And that's the use of the pardon power. The abuse of the pardon power is for favoritism, for friends. And so what you see here unfolding is exactly the scenario that many of the founders, particularly the anti-federalist faction, were most worried about, that this awesome pardon power would be used for friends, to benefit friends and allies, regardless of the merits of their cases. And so, you know, when you talk about the January 6th pardons, he did not go through and say, okay, John Smith here and Jane Smith, the evidence shows that a police officer in this state of confusion and sort of the fog of all of the conflict let them in, and then they were prosecuted when someone just let them in. And then here's somebody else who we have them on video beating a police officer with a flagpole or beating them with their fists. That person is a violent criminal. There's no sort of confusion or getting out of hand argument for them. They're assaulting a cop. He didn't do that. He didn't do that kind of inquiry. When instead he said, everybody gets pardon or clemency there. And so even the most violent, even the most depraved received unmerited favor from Donald Trump. This is exactly what many of the founders were worried about. And when you go back and you look at those early debates, what was the answer from the defenders of the Constitution? Madison arose and said, oh, we can deal with that through impeachment. Impeachment right. is the remedy.
We've seen so how powerful the impeachment mechanism has been in Trump's case.
Right. But yeah. but what this also shows us is the very thing that Donald Trump did, no lesser a founder than James Madison would say, that's impeachment worthy. That right. that's beyond the pale. And so it's not just sort of the obvious injustice of obviously guilty people have who have engaged in violent attacks on law enforcement have been granted a reprieve by this president solely because they're his political allies and they committed violence for him. But what we're seeing is it's not just that in isolation. This is also systemic. It's exposing a systemic problem with the power, the way this president is exercising his power.
Hmm. How is it that he can, on the one hand, spin himself as the law and order president, and on the other hand, pardon people who we've watched attack police officers on video, and there's no apparent cognitive dissonance suffered by his supporters? I mean, does anyone in Trumpistan break with him over that contradiction, the fact that he didn't distinguish
because
among
the
rioters?
Your key word there was in Trumpistan. You know, if you are in Trumpistan, you believe the election was stolen. If you're in Trumpistan, you believe that the entire January 6th riot and attack, if anyone is really to blame, it's Nancy Pelosi for not having sufficient security at the Capitol. In true Trumpistan, they believe that without foundation, that many of these January 6th protesters were imprisoned and prosecuted without real due process. So in Trumpistan, you have people who believe that the January 6th protests were exaggerated in their violence, no worse than, say, the protesters who would occupy parts of the Capitol building, say, to protest the Kavanaugh nomination, that the real violence that happened during that era was far-left violence in the Black Lives Matter protests.
Right.
And so they just have a completely different view of what occurred on January 6th, that the violence was exaggerated, that the protests were legitimate, that the election was actually stolen. And so they're going to look at a lot of those January 6ers as sort of heirs to 1776, that these were patriots intervening on behalf of a president who was wrongly denied the presidency. So they're living in a different universe from many, many, many millions of other Americans.
Is there more to say about the Bolton case? I mean, I remember before the FBI raid of his house, I mean, this is more or less right after Trump was inaugurated, he withdrew the security detail from Bolton, who, by all accounts, had credible threats against him from Iran. So I mean, the vindictiveness was easily and early established and clear. And it seems like whatever the merits of this case, again, we neither of us know if Bolton's holding on to any documents he shouldn't be holding on to. But it just seems like the president has telegraphed his motives in focusing the Justice Department on people like Bolton. From the outset.
Well, this is why you don't do that. This is why you don't name political enemies. Kash Patel, for example, had an enemies list in his book. When you name your political enemies, what that means, and you name them and identify them and you take vengeance against them. So, for example, by lifting a security detail, what that does is it casts a shadow on all of the actions going forward. So, for example, neither you nor I don't have seen the search warrant or have seen the filings in court to ask for the search warrant. So we don't know the underlying evidence or lack thereof. All we know are the surrounding circumstances. And this is why you don't identify targets. This is why you don't engage in vengeful actions, because who right now can have any confidence at all that this investigation is being conducted professionally? The only thing that is keeping me from saying, clearly, this is a politically targeted raid is the fact that federal judges did sign off on these warrants. So there was a check there. Now, it's easy to get a search warrant. It's not difficult to get a search warrant, but there is at least some degree of judicial review that tells me that a federal judge saw this and thought there is at least some reason for probable cause. So I cannot adjudge the underlying merits of that search warrant. But what I can do is I can say that when you engage in public vilification of your political enemies, when you do things like Kash Patel spiking the football, what that does is it communicates to everyone that this is a political attack, not that this is the dispassionate, even-handed operation of justice. And then let's say, Sam, that there was actual evidence of a crime. For the sake of argument, let's assume there was evidence of a crime. You've just really undermined your ability to get a conviction, because if I'm a halfway competent criminal defense lawyer, just mouth-breathingly competent as a criminal defense lawyer, I can walk into a jury and say, this is all political. And I can pull up quote after quote, action after action, note how they deviated from standard Department of Justice practice. And then I'll turn to the jury and they're going to give you a bunch of complicated mumbo jumbo about how Ambassador Bolton violated these highly technical and highly intricate security clearance requirements. But I'm going to tell you, that's a smokescreen. What's really going on is this, and I can point to comment after comment. So
the president calling him a lowlife.
Yeah. So you're actually, in many ways, you're undermining the system of justice on the front end and the back end, because you're undermining confidence that these investigations are even-handed, and you're undermining your prosecution, even if you uncover criminal wrongdoing.
What about the accusations that President Obama is guilty of treason? Treason, if I'm not mistaken, treason, I don't know if it always carries a death sentence, but it can carry a death sentence.
It can, yeah.
Well, I mean, what are we to make of, there's two things. One, the accusation was made. Two, there's so much else has happened in the meantime that it was promptly memory-holed, and it's probably not even in anyone's top 10 of the most interesting things that have happened in the last 6 months. But to have a sitting president accuse the prior one of possibly a capital offense, and to say that he's now being investigated, that's a 20 megaton piece of news that would completely subsume the presidency of any other president.
Oh, absolutely it would. And it really does go back to that Bannon flood the zone with shit kind of formulation, where if you're just shoveling outrage into the public, you do induce fatigue. You do sort of induce this situation where, you know, I'm sure you've seen that GIF online of Homer Simpson with his eyes wide, just retreating back into the shrubbery.
Yeah.
This is the natural human reaction to just nonstop outrage, nonstop crisis, nonstop sense of alarm. Is a lot of people just back away from that. And so you're exactly right. I mean, we could do this, the whole conversation, we could point to this or that thing that happened 4 days ago or 10 days ago or 2 months ago, and it will feel like 5 years ago because so many other things have happened.
Hmm.
And it just creates a sense of what you might think of as just almost irresistible momentum, that this is just the way things are now. And you either accept it and go along with the tide or resist it and get crushed by it. And I think this is a very intentional strategy. The difference between Trump 1 and 1.0 and Trump 2.0 is vast. There's actually a lot of people around him who have a specific theory of power and are using Trump's impulsiveness and vindictiveness to pursue that theory of power.
Mm. Well, let's talk about that theory of power. You've written about the ways in which we're discovering that the Constitution has been an insufficient bulwark against the impulses of a corrupt authoritarian president. And I guess let's touch a point specifically which you raised in a recent New York Times piece about why Congress has been so ineffectual. And I'm going to read you a quote here. You wrote in criticism of this notion of co-equal branches of government, which, you know, this is a phrase that many of us have in our heads. And you wrote, "Our nation is not supposed to have co-equal branches. Congress is supposed to reign supreme. Yes, the other branches have the power to check Congress. Presidents can veto legislation. Courts exercise judicial review. But Congress alone possesses the power of the purse. Congress alone is supposed to possess the power to declare war. Congress can impeach and remove members of the executive and judicial branches of government, including the president and justices of the Supreme Court." This does not seem to describe the Congress that we have. I mean, so what is, I mean, you in this piece, you also recommend that we amend Article 2 of the Constitution. Give me a little color on the problem here.
Yeah, so if you go back and you read the Federalist Papers, you will see that the construct is that ambition is made to check ambition. In other words, there's no one collection of people or no one person who can be trusted with power. And so when you look at the federal system that was created, that Madisonian democracy that was created, every part of the government is made to check every other part of the government, at least to some extent. However, objectively, the most power was handed to the most representative branch of government, which is the legislature. Objectively, it has more power than the presidency. It has more power than the Supreme Court. However, this is a miscalculation. Madison, writing the writing and formulating, and as they're working on the Constitution, as he's defending the Constitution in the Federalist Papers, he misidentified a bit where power comes from and where ambition comes from. And so he was thinking that if you have a Speaker of the House, that the Speaker of the House is going to have a lot of jealousy around the power that comes from being Speaker of the House, and that he would not want anything to happen to limit the power that the Speaker of the House has, that he would take an enormous amount of ambition and pour it into that position, and he would then defend that position in the same way that he would think about members of Congress, that as congressmen, that they would want to defend the powers that they have as congressmen. Now, he's writing all of this, and this is all being put together before the rise of the modern political party. And if you go back to Washington's farewell address, if you go back to the contentions around the election of 1800 and elections following that, political parties got very powerful very quickly. Washington saw the dangers of them, warned against them to no avail. But what it began to happen is the political party became the location of the source of power, more so in many cases than the position that you occupy in the government. And who is the leader of the political party? Well, it is the president. The president is the de facto leader of the particular political party. And so if you are of the same party as the president, and let's say you're a Speaker of the House like Mike Johnson, then you are seen in the public's eyes, in your own voters' eyes often, as somehow disloyal if you are defying the leader of your party. And so it is, in fact, the case that Mike Johnson, by exerting his own independent authority as Speaker of the House, could actually lose his position in government because he's defying the leader of his party. And over time, this message became so inculcated into Congress that congressmen, you know, members of Congress see their jobs either as supporting or opposing a president, right, not as exercising independent power and authority. They are supporting or opposing a president. So in that situation, the president is the sun and the legislature are the planets that orbit around the sun. And the sun defines their role. It defines them as for or against based on their partisanship. And that's the way our system has developed over time. And now we're so locked into it that the Congress right now is the least powerful branch of government. It doesn't matter really and truly compared to the others. And so that's in the absolute inverse of what the founders wanted. And so therefore, our entire system is under a degree of strain because it's upside down. It is not functioning. The power is not being exercised where it's supposed to be exercised. And that's creating all kinds of downstream effects in American politics and culture.
And this problem preceded Trump. It's just Trump has made it truly intolerable in the way that he's busted all the norms of our politics and democratic governance.
Right. Let's put it this way. Other presidents walked so that Trump could run. We have seen a series of presidencies, really, ever since it was during the Nixon presidency that the term the imperial presidency was coined. There were some immediate post-Watergate attempts to claw back some of that power from the presidency. But really, since Carter and rolling since Carter, each president has tried to incrementally grasp more and more and more authority, unilateral authority, to the point now where Donald Trump, it reminds me of the old, the Hemingway quote, how does a company go bankrupt slowly and then suddenly?
Yeah, yeah.
How does a presidency become, a quasi-monarchy slowly and then suddenly? And we've seen that happen.
Mm. So I don't remember the exact language of the clause in Article 2 conferring, the role of the executive on the president or the language of your proposed amendment? I don't know if you've got both, but what surgery are you recommending to the Constitution?
Yeah, so it's a change in the first sentence. So presently, the first sentence says, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. Very plain, very simple. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America, which then raises a question. What is the executive power? What is that? What is that thing called the executive power? And the ambiguity over that, this is something the anti-federalists identified early on. They said that's a vague and inexplicit sentence. And when you have ambiguity and when you have vagueness and you combine that with ambition, that ambiguity creates a space into which people pour their will to power. And so what you're beginning to see is an emergent legal theory that essentially says the executive power is something that is so strong in some circumstances that it can override the legislative power of Congress. And so what I would be proposing is that instead of a sentence says that the executive power shall be invested in a president of the United States, it would be a president of the United States shall execute the laws passed by Congress. So this flips this. There is no longer any sort of freestanding executive power that exists separate and apart from Congress. No. The executive power that exists is the power to execute the laws passed by Congress. Now, of course, those laws would be subject to judicial review. Other enumerated powers of the president would stay, such as being commander in chief, etc.
And those laws wouldn't pass without the president deciding whether to veto those laws in the first place.
There would still be veto power, exactly. Right. But the background basic power of the president would be limited to executing laws passed by Congress.
Yeah.
As of right now, that phrase, the executive power, is being read so capaciously that it is even including a theory that the president can decide which laws in their executive discretion to enforce or not to enforce. And so that the executive power is so great that it includes an executive discretion to not enforce laws passed by Congress, which is a remarkable power grab from the president. And so that is, if you change that sentence, you radically reorient the government to the exact hierarchy intended by the founders.
Well, I don't know which sounds more quixotic at this moment in history, building a colony on Mars or amending the U.S. Constitution. It's great to talk about the prospect and, you know, the way you describe it, it seems totally warranted. I mean, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I'm sold that we should perform that piece of surgery. Are these just empty words or is it conceivable to you that in the next term, we have a sane, non-ideological, democratic, big D, democratic president. Is it conceivable to you that a freshly minted president, I don't know who I'm picturing here, but it's probably not Gavin Newsom, but let's say even President Gavin Newsom, would such a person elect to make this an issue, that to look back over the recent history of the presidency and say, so much of what ails us is that we only had norms where we thought we had laws, and now we need laws to backstop the norms we all know we want. And so the first thing I'm going to do as president is reduce some of the power of the presidency. Is it possible that we could elect such a person?
Yes, it's possible. It's not probable anytime soon, with a caveat. So when you said at this present moment, it's more likely that we could, is it more likely to pass an amendment or build a colony on Mars? It's the easy answer. It's more likely to get to Mars at this present moment than there is to pass a constitutional amendment. Because right now we're in a position where we have, it's a 51-49 country flipping back and forth as to who's the 51 and who's the 49 on any given election cycle. And so you have to have supermajorities to pass constitutional amendments. And so constitutional amendments at the moment are dead on arrival. However, it is foolish to think that this present moment is permanent and that this is the new permanence of American politics. We have been through periods of close polarization before, and usually they end with a period of dominance. And so the question that I have is, when all of this comes crashing down, when this present moment ends, what will replace it? what is it that we will, and we should be preparing for that eventuality. We should not just be attempting to resist the worst excesses of the Trump administration. We should be preparing to rebuild this constitutional republic if and when the moment comes where the American people realize this sucks. We have got to make a fundamental change. And I agree with you, Sam. I think the irony of it all is that given our reality, it is going to take presidential leadership to diminish the power of the president. So a president is going to have to walk in and say, if you're in with both houses of Congress and say, if you're a good Democrat or if you're a good Republican, you're going to vote with me to permanently transform the presidency into a lesser office. And so it's going to take presidential leadership, I think, to diminish the power of the president. And you might think, well, that's crazy. That's ridiculous. Who would ever agree to do that? Well, one of the reasons why the Republic has lasted as long as it has is because the very first president, George Washington, set an example of humility and restraint that endured for a really long time. And so we actually do have a historical example of somebody walking in choosing explicitly not to exercise all of the power, and to establish practices of restraint and humility in presidential leadership that stood for a very, very long time. Think, for example, of the two-term limit. That two terms for president, that was just a practice. That was a habit established by George Washington that everyone followed until FDR. Right. So that's a very long time where a practice of restraint had an, you know, had influence. So I do think, ironically enough, it will take a president walking in the door and saying, as part of my leadership, we are going to shed power from the executive branch, but then creating permanent changes through law, through constitutional amendments that hamper and hamstring presidents going forward.
Mm. Well, how fully have things unraveled from your point of view at this point? I mean, how far down the path toward, it's hard to know what term to use. I mean, authoritarianism, I guess, is the most generic. I mean, people talk about tyranny or fascism, which isn't quite right historically. But still, there are many academics I could name who sound about as shrill as they can sound on this topic, that the wheels have fully come off and it's going to take a while to realize the implications, but we're in some kind of free fall condition. Are you that alarmed, or are you in some orbit of concern that is not quite out there with the Timothy Snyders of the world, or Jason Stanley, I think is the other academic who actually moved to Canada. I mean, I put someone like Ann Applebaum, who I recently spoke to on the podcast, as definitely an orbit below those two other people I just named in terms of, I mean, she's quite concerned, but also quite sober and nuanced in her shrieks of horror. Where are you at this moment?
So I am at the point where I'm not at the point where I'm looking for real estate and outside of Toronto, or if I did, it'd be Vancouver. Vancouver's beautiful, but I'm not at the point where I'm looking for real estate in England or Canada or wherever. I'm not at the point where we're past some sort of point of no return. However, I will say that in a couple of institutions, the Department of Justice, and then I'm getting increasingly worried about the Department of Defense, we might be at or very near a point of no return for a generation level, a generation's worth of consequences. Let me put it that way. And I would say that we're getting closer and closer to the point where people who are prominent critics of Trump, I have talked to a number of people since the raid on Bolton who have been prominent critics of Trump, and they're just waiting for the federal government to show up at their door. I think we're beginning to get to a point where, at least in the next, between now and the midterms, you may very well see more targeted, very targeted political prosecutions. You will see a kind of autocratic style and brutal style of punitive, quote unquote, justice being inflicted on Trump's enemies. And we even have not talked enough about the violations of due process with migrants, the mistreatment of migrants in detention facilities. This is the kind of stuff that when it's fully out and exposed, future generations of Americans will look back and say to their grandparents, why didn't you say something? Right.
Yeah.
So it's very, very serious. But my definition of when we've passed some sort of point of no return is, have we reached a point where electoral repudiation is no longer possible? Mm. In other words, that point where relatively soon in multiple instances of autocratic rule, where elections no longer either happen or matter. That's at the point where you would really just be pressing the alarm button, screaming, yelling, jumping up and down that we have passed the point of no return. But we're still in the world where a decisive electoral repudiation can heal America from an awful lot of this. It's just that the problem that we have is we don't see an electoral repudiation on the horizon. And if that is the case, then that's beginning to get us into this really, really grim and uncomfortable territory about whether a decisive number of Americans, a sufficient number of Americans to keep Trump and MAGA either in power or close to power indefinitely, have just decided this is the kind of country they want. This is, they look at all this and don't see anything alarming at all. They applaud it. They love it. And that's the circumstance where a decisive repudiation by the electorate, if that is not possible, then that tells me that we're suffering from is one of the scenarios that the founders worried about a great deal, which was not just the advent of a sort of a monarchy, but the advent of vindictive mob rule, vindictive popular rule. And so if all of this is ratified by the electorate, that's with each passing year, with the electorate continuing to ratify this more, that's where it just gets darker and darker and darker.
Yeah. Well, I guess be the MAGA whisperer for me yet again. I don't understand how people don't see a bright line politically and ethically being crossed here. The case where that was quite glaring from my point of view, because you know, I can see it clearly, even though I'm not disposed to be so charitable to the victim at this moment. So I mean, when Elon Musk broke up with Trump in spectacular fashion, and Trump threatened him both with the loss of government contracts and especially if he backed Democratic opponents in the future, bad things were going to happen to him. That seemed like such a shock. It's beyond un-American. I mean, it's a complete repudiation of the American idea of government, right? I mean, to have a sitting president say, if you in the future support my political opponents or political opponents from the other party, of anyone in the Republican Party, bad things are going to happen to you from my office. It seemed that no one cared. No one noticed this. There are like tech bro friends of Elon's who are in the administration who just swallowed that.
Yeah. I mean, part of this is just the hubris of man. So you have these tech bros who are not Elon, who've seen how Trump turned on Elon, and they're like, well, Elon was dumb. He did X or Y or Z. That won't happen to me. You know, it's the way in which people can delude themselves, especially the closer they get to power, that A, they belong there. B, they know how to navigate these halls of power. And C, all of the horrible things that happened to everyone who came before them are not going to happen to them. I mean, our capacity to delude ourselves is almost boundless, especially the bigger the carrot you dangle in front of someone, the more they're going to delude themselves into thinking they're entitled to that carrot. So whereas the tech bros should have been looking at that, Trump turning on Elon and saying, if the most powerful tech lord can have the wheels of the bus just roll straight over him, I'm even more vulnerable than Elon. What, you know, but no. There's this sort of sense that, well, he transgressed. And so you have this sort of boundless human hubris that is keeping a lot of people close to Trump because they think they can manage him. They think that they've got it all figured out. And then they've got this other thing where when Elon went hard towards Trump, a lot of people saw Trump turn on Elon and they didn't greet it and say, this is terrible, this is alarming. They had schadenfreude. They were like, yeah, okay, look at what happened to you when you turned on Trump. And so they kind of take a perverse sort of glee in it rather than removing themselves from the moment, sort of removing their emotional investment in Elon Musk, the man, and instead saying, what kind of system of government are we developing here? So, you know, and you see this a little bit with Bolton. I've been very glad to see a lot of people say, across the spectrum, say, this is, okay, we haven't seen the search warrant, but the circumstances here are very alarming. But then at the same time, you know, Bolton's been a partisan Republican for a long time. He does not like Democrats. He's very publicly said he didn't support, you know, Kamala Harris. And so there are people who are so partisan that they have difficulty showing any sympathy, much less empathy, for somebody that isn't in their tribe who has the crosshairs. And so a lot of this is short-sighted and partisan. Some of it is arrogant, But we construct a lot of different ways to protect ourselves from seeing what is actually happening. Because if we see what is actually happening, it is very alarming. It is very disturbing, and it calls for urgent action. But that requires exposing ourselves to critique or to hatred or to hostile government forces. I mean, it requires risk. So, Sam, I think we're starting to see how things like Jim Crow could last for a very long time, even though their injustice was blindingly obvious, because to change injustice requires risk. To confront injustice requires risk. And when push comes to shove, not a lot of people are willing to endure any real risk for the sake of somebody else.
Okay, I'm going to, in a more rapid-fire way, bring up a bunch of horrors and indiscretions and get your reaction to them. Maybe I'll bring them up in a kind of devil's advocate vein. So you mentioned immigration and the expansion of ICE. What is wrong with this? I mean, so most people, and I would say most sane people in our society, are in favor of a border that is secure, right? We want to know who's coming into the country.
True. Yeah.
And why that, you know, was such a controversial issue until Trump seized it and more or less won on it is a little hard to understand. And it was just a spectacular own goal from the Democrats to have equated concerns about border security with racism for however many years they did
that. Absurd, yeah.
Yeah. So we agree that we want a defensible border, and Trump has achieved that or is in the process of fully achieving that. If we don't want people rounded up in car washes and construction sites and thrown out of the country, well, why have laws against illegal immigration in the first place, right? These people are here illegally. You know, if you have laws, why not enforce them? And why is the onus on ICE or Trump or anyone else in the system, Kristi Noem, for enforcing laws that we in fact have, right? So, and the reason why these guys are showing up in too much force and are all masked is because we've got lunatics who are doxing them or throwing pieces of concrete at them. And it's dangerous to be a cop. It's dangerous to be a member of ICE. We should be sympathetic to how onerous that work is. And again, the work is legal because we have the laws on our books saying that you can't be here illegally in the first place. What's wrong with any of this? This is just good policy.
Well, let's start with the masking first. Masking is utterly inexcusable. I mean, look, I understand better than the average person that doxing occurs, that threats happen. It's been happening to us and to my family for years and years and years. I get it. It's terrifying. It's scary. But a public official showing their face is one of the ways that you know you're dealing with a public official. Flashing a face and an ID as opposed to a mask and not identifying yourself. Extraordinarily dangerous stuff. Vicious and horrible people can take advantage of those kinds of practices, you know, to engage in criminal behavior. I mean, there's just no excuse for masking. Just as a practical matter, a moral matter, no excuse for it. Now, as far as the rest of it, 100% agree that there should be an enforceable border. This was one of Joe Biden's great failures. I mean, it was, when you look at the raw numbers of people who came across and the total ineffectiveness of his border control measures, this is a key reason why he lost. And Democrats were understanding this even well before the election when they tried to pass a tougher border bill. They tried to pass a bill that would clamp down on the border. So Democrats, by 2024, realized this. They realized that the far left and a lot of these online shrieking voices on the far left were not representative of the American people at all. And they engaged in a series of policy choices that were terrible. Now, what do you do about it? What do you do about it? Well, it turns out that we have a long history of presidents, including President Obama, deporting an awful lot of people, but doing so humanely, doing so without racial profiling, doing so without shipping people to foreign prisons where they suffer cruel and inhumane and degrading conditions. They do so without disrupting underlying economic realities. And so it is very possible to deport lots of people who should be deported without engaging in tactics that are violent, hidden, masked, large-scale seizures that are pulling in legal American residents, pulling in American citizens, that without engaging in treatment of migrants and detainees that is cruel and inhumane. I mean, we're talking, Sam, about treating people who've crossed the border illegally, which is a the only time it raises to a felony is if it's just repeated attempts to unlawfully cross. We're talking about treating people who've had misdemeanor level offenses worse in some cases than we treat people who've committed armed robbery or committed acts of violence in the way that they're treated in these detention facilities and their access to counsel and their access to relatives. And it's some of the allegations that we're seeing regarding the treatment of detainees and migrants is shocking stuff. Mm. And so this idea that, well, you know, we got to deport a lot of people. Yes, there are a lot of people who should be deported. Absolutely, totally agree with that. But guess what? Trump's not the first president to be president of the United States, and he's not the first president to deport people. And we've had a deportation regime that has deported millions of people without large-scale inhumanity, without large, big sweeps in city streets, and without subjecting people to cruel and degrading and inhumane treatment, without subjecting even American citizens and asylum applicants and people who have received permission to stay in this country without subjecting them to horrific mistreatment.
Yeah.
You can enforce a border and treat people humanely at the same time. We've done it most of our history. Mm.
Okay, how about crime on our city streets? What's wrong with having the military support local law enforcement if local law enforcement can't get the job done? Are there carjackings and other crimes in D.C. that should be intolerable to us? It's the capital of our great nation. It's one of the, perhaps not most dangerous, but more dangerous cities in America. Crime has not fallen there as quickly as it should since 2020. Trump just wants the Capitol to be as inspiring a place as it can be. What's wrong with the National Guard in there?
Well, two things can be true at once. So you can have serious decreases in crime. There have been real improvements in law enforcement in D.C. since 2020. The crime rate has been decreasing. Violent crime is down substantially. Murders are down substantially. And it can still be too much. Mm. So I do not think that the way to defend or to attack the Trump deployment to Washington, D.C. is by saying Washington, D.C. is fine. No.
Right.
Washington, D.C. is not fine. It does need the crime decreases that have happened. The crime reductions are incredibly important, but then more needs to be done. But you can grant that there is a crime problem without also then saying that the way to deal with it is putting boots on the ground of American troops in streets. There's many reasons for this. Let's begin with one. They're not trained for law enforcement, okay? This is not what they're trained to do. Even military police, even an MP, is trained to enforce the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They're not trained to enforce D.C. laws or, you know, if the rumored deployments to Chicago, for example, materialize. They're not trained to enforce Chicago laws, to enforce Illinois laws. They're not trained in the full range of constitutional rights that private citizens in their own cities and towns enjoy. They're just not trained for this. So what happens? Okay, well, you say, well, train them up for it. Pick one. Train them for their military mission, which is deterring and defeating the enemies of the United States, or for a law enforcement mission. Mm. And when you begin to divert the military into law enforcement, into domestic security, you begin to get to the problem that a lot of authoritarians have discovered when they try to use their military that's quite good at maintaining internal security, deploying against foreign powers, doesn't go so well. So keep the military focused on the main thing, which is our external enemies. That's number one. Number two, the more you deploy the military into our city streets, the more you make the military a partisan perceived, although the military has no ability to defy a lawful order. If you have ridiculous spectacles, like a whole bunch of red state governors wanting to send their National Guard into blue states, what you then begin to create is a perception that the military is an instrument of partisan vengeance rather than a unifying representative of the entire national whole. Mm. And so you then begin to undermine recruitment and confidence in the military itself. The military is the most trusted public institution in the United States. It's not even close. But the instant the military is seen as Donald Trump's personal instrument of vengeance against blue America, that will change. Number three, you start to undermine the morale within the military. The military is an incredibly politically diverse place. The way I've put it, I served in the Army as a JAG officer in the reserves for 8 years. I deployed active duty to Iraq. I spent time in South Korea, Italy, other places. And the one thing that I've told people is that the military is as diverse as universities claim to be. that the military actually is a diverse institution. Most universities are very monolithic in one or more areas, mainly ideologically. The military is very diverse. So you've got a lot of people who are not MAGA at all, and some who are quite MAGA. And if it becomes an instrument of MAGA, you're going to undermine the morale and cohesion within the military. So you've got a force not trained for law enforcement, that its public regard will diminish, and it depends on its public regard for its recruiting, and its internal cohesion will diminish. And the final thing is, it isn't necessary to deploy troops to improve law enforcement.
Yeah.
We have many, many cities with much lower rates of crime than Washington, D.C., without National Guard troops. New York City, although Trump wants to, apparently has talked about taking that over, fraction of the crime rate of Washington, D.C. You have many American cities with fractions of the crime rates of some of our worst cities. How did they do it? What is different about them? Better law enforcement works. We know this. And so this idea that says, well, if we want to improve our criminal justice, we have to deploy the military. No, we have long records of better civilian law enforcement resulting in better outcomes. Do better civilian law enforcement. Don't divert the mission of the military, expand it beyond its training, create problems with unit cohesion, create problems potentially with recruitment, and then create greater divisions within the American body politic as parts of America feel like we're now under military control because we didn't vote for this president. You can be absolutely dedicated to diminishing the threat of violent crime, as I am, without saying that that means, by necessity, pulling in boots on the ground who are not trained for it, when it could impair the public's perception of the military, impair unit cohesion in the military, push the military into a situation where it's less capable of addressing foreign threats because it's diverting to train up and to deal with domestic threats. And all of those things, all of these negative consequences are not just the cost of fighting crime. We can fight crime without pulling in the military and without it becoming something that looks an awful lot to blue state Americans like a threatened military occupation just because they didn't vote for the right candidate.
How concerned are you about the expansion of ICE and that this could become, you know, in the extreme case, Trump's version of the Stasi, you know, or Praetorian Guard? I mean, like, they could be weaponized in some way that is beyond an immigration and customs mandate.
I am much less concerned about the expansion of ICE than I am the diminishing of training standards. So I do think, for example, if you've had a very, very large influx of illegal immigrants into the country, you might need to staff up more immigration judges, for example, more people hearing asylum cases, more ICE agents for enforcement. I can see, absolutely see a need to staff up, not to the level that they're doing now. But the concern that I have is less with staffing levels than with training and tactics. And when you try to expand law enforcement rapidly, and when you try to really ramp up the number of officers, what you often end up doing is cutting corners, diminishing amount of training time, and then that yields problems down the line. It's kind of like, when I've talked about defending against terrorism, if you allow terrorists to have safe havens, they will strike you. You don't know necessarily when, you don't necessarily know how or how bad it will be, but you know if terrorists have safe havens to plan, raise money, train, et cetera, they're going for you. Similarly, if you massively expand law enforcement and if you cut corners on training and you flood the streets with the people who are not adequately trained.
It's not just training, it's also recruitment. If you're training the wrong people, you don't want to be training up Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and neo-Nazis and lunatics.
Exactly. Yeah. So you select the wrong people, you train them poorly, then the clock starts ticking on some terrible incident. You don't know when it'll happen, you don't know how bad it will be, but just the clock starts ticking on some dreadful, dreadful abuses of power. And so I'm absolutely, and then when you add to that, they're allowed to run around anonymously wearing masks, not identifying themselves. It creates an atmosphere of impunity and abuse that I'm just telling you right now, just set your watch. It's going to happen. It's coming.
How concerned are you about the Christian right at this point? What are the ethno-nationalists and the Christian identitarians and the white supremacists, et cetera, doing? And I guess I have a, let me kind of jump to the end of the question here. Maybe it just, it deflates the logic of it. But I would think that the Christian right is getting more or less everything it wants now, right? I mean, the pressure should be out of the system, at least on that side of our politics. I mean, I could imagine if we had President Kamala Harris implementing the next DEI shibboleth at as a matter of national policy, the Christian right would be boiling over with rage. Now they're just kind of picking from, you know, desserts from the menu. Why wouldn't the risk of that culture, you know, exporting, you know, chaos or violence or anything else to the rest of society be reduced in the current circumstance?
Well, you know, I think one thing that's important to understand about the religious right, and when you say the religious right, what we're mainly talking about is white evangelicals.
Right. Although I'm talking, you know, I'm not just talking about sincere Bible-believing evangelicals. I'm talking about the culture that birthed, you know, people like Timothy McVeigh and like that, like the Christian identitarian reconstructionist millenarian, you know, the rapture is going to be next Tuesday brigade. I mean, like the people who are waiting for everything to get terrible with some sense of glee.
Well, that cohort of outright explicit Christian nationalists, the people who say, I am a Christian nationalist, or the people who would say the phrase that some of them use now is I'm a heritage American, which means white in their view. The if you're going to talk about these kinds of people who are really on the far right fringes, they're living their best life right now. They have an access to power, an audience with power that they've never enjoyed before. And there's a perfect example in this person, Doug Wilson, who's out in Moscow, Idaho, is somebody who is a self-avowed paleo-Confederate Christian nationalist who believes that the 19th Amendment should be repealed. And the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, goes to one of his churches that he's established. Right. And that when he was interviewed on CNN, Hegseth puts out on Twitter, all of Christ for all of life, a saying of this community in support of this guy. After, you know, the CNN report, he talks about, you know, pastors in that denomination talk about repealing the 19th Amendment.
Was so Wilson always so extreme? Because I don't think I might have met him once briefly. He was debating toward the end of Christopher Hitchens' life. He debated Wilson several times, and it was, recall it being a fairly collegial, like touring act. I mean, I think they had, you know, multiple debates, and again, I didn't, I'd have to go back and look, but I don't remember him being as extreme as he currently seems. Are you aware of what his evolution was?
He was extreme. I mean, Wilson's a collegial guy. Like, he's a friendly guy. So, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people think of extremists as like snarling, angry people, right? And they're kind of thrown off if an extremist is like, hey, Sam, great to see you. How are you doing? You know,
have you met my friend Mussolini?
Yeah. And it's weird how just friendliness often turns down our threat detector, right? But, you know, he was in the 90s, he wrote a pamphlet where he talked about how, you know, abolitionists were defying the word of God, and that the best race relations that ever existed were in the antebellum South. I mean, like this just wild stuff like that. And he's actually kind of dialed that down a bit since that time. So he's always been quite extreme. He's just never been as influential as he is now. And I could see why Hitchens would want to debate him, because Hitchens would be debating in many ways an actual Christian extremist, not somebody who's going to necessarily present the best foot forward for evangelical Christianity. But that Doug Wilson kind of person is having their best time right now. But what's interesting is, even though evangelicals have won a lot, and this has been going on for a while, you know, just take, for example, an area I worked in, religious liberty. It has been 15 years since there was a significant religious liberty loss at the Supreme Court. 15 years, okay? And yet, I guarantee you, the next presidential election, the religious conservatives will be saying, if we don't win, religious liberty will be destroyed. Mm. So no matter how many victories you win, in this world, you're told it is always 6 minutes to midnight. Always. You're always one election from destruction. And what that has created is a sense of permanent crisis and deep animosity in big parts of the religious conservative world. They think that their worship, their lifestyle, all their values are under imminent, immediate threat every election. And no amount of victory, no single victory is enough to pull them out of peril. And so that's one of the reasons why they glommed on to Trump so much, is they thought, finally, somebody who sees the threat from the left as clearly as we see the threat from the left, and will fight the left as much as we want somebody to fight for the left. And it, to such an extent that it is now completely old news, outdated, laugh out loud, hilarious, ridiculous, to hear people say, well, the evangelical world is holding its nose for Trump. No, 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 no. Mm. Nobody loves Trump more than white evangelicals. I mean, if you look at by every religious subgroup in America, compared to white evangelicals, either dislikes Trump or is very evenly split on him. But even right now, 72% of white evangelicals support the job Trump is doing. They have positive job approval for Trump. The next largest group is white Catholics at 51%. So that's how much white evangelicals are an outlier in supporting Trump. And they're operating under a lot of fear. If he loses, we're going to be swept away. And they're also operating under prophecies. There are people and very influential people with massive followings who have been telling particularly Pentecostals that Trump is God's man to save America, that he has been prophesied to save America. And so by opposing Trump, you're opposing the very will of God in this construct. And so this is not your grandfather's religious conservative movement. This is a new movement very heavily influenced by its Pentecostal wing, and its Pentecostal wing is teaching millions of people that God chose Trump and they have special divine revelation to support that. And that's creating a sort of religious zeal around Trump that is very scary to see. Mm.
Has the America First component of this and the kind of new isolationism with respect to foreign policy eroded the support for Israel on the Christian right? Or is that, or the Christians, the evangelicals and the Pentecostals just still locked to their millenarian expectations about how that we're going to ride or die with Israel until the Messiah comes and then things change a little bit?
I would put it this way. There's a generational divide and an online-offline divide. Mm. So if you're talking about a median Republican 55-year-old man or 75-year-old man or woman who is not living and dying, you know, not living every day on Twitter and living and dying by the Twitter trends, right? Then they're 1,000,000,000% rock solid for Israel still. I mean, absolutely all in 1,000,000,000%. Where you're seeing the divide is in the online, younger world of the religious right. You're beginning to see anti-Semitism popping up. You're beginning to see Tucker Carlsonism, Candace Owensism.
Yeah.
You're beginning to see this sort of extraordinarily conspiratorial worldview. And we both know that when extraordinary conspiracies arise, anti-Semitism is always right around the corner when you're dealing about conspiratorial thinking. And so I would say it is an absolute exaggeration to say that that Twitterverse of young Christian nationalists is strongly influential offline with your average Republican Christian. Nah.
Hmm.
But do they indicate something emerging within the religious right? Absolutely, 100%. And a lot of the smarter people on the religious conservative side are saying, we've got a problem with younger people, and the anti-Semitism element of it is one of the leading edge indicators. Now, I'm not equating opposition with Israel with anti-Semitism, but what I am saying is that the rise of disagreement with Israel on the religious right or on the far right is connected to anti-Semitism. Right. There is a lot of connection to anti-Semitism there.
Hmm. Well, it brings me to a final question. I guess the conspiracy theories that have a juicy anti-Semitic core, perhaps the Epstein story, is that in the process of going away as we speak, or do you think that is going to be continuously frustrating the president until some other shoe drops?
So I stand by what I wrote in the first like 48 hours after all this blew up, which was, if you think that Epstein is going to take down Trump, that be an inconvenience for Trump? Yeah. Bother Trump? Yeah. But see, be something important in actually undermining his base of support for him? No. And we see no real degradation in his overall approval rating since the Epstein stuff came out. But that doesn't mean it isn't really important. And here's what's really important about it. The Epstein stuff does divide MAGA. It really does. Mm. And so it doesn't divide MAGA in the extent that they'll separate from Trump, but it sets MAGA against each other. There are elements and people who say, well, we need to move along and go with what Trump and the administration said, and a whole other group that's saying, no, we don't move on, we don't go along with it. Now, it's not, they're not turning on Trump, but they're really turning on each other.
Right.
And this is the thing that I think not enough people are paying attention to yet, which is we're so focused on what Trump is doing now that we're not thinking enough about how the coalition that he's assembled is going to be very difficult to sustain once he's not the unifying figure anymore. Once he's gone from the scene, think of it like this. He's collected a bag of scorpions. The Republican coalition, it includes anti-vax and pro-vax, it includes pro-Ukraine, anti-Ukraine, it includes pro-choice, pro-life, it includes people on all sides of issues. So long as they put on the red hat and bend the knee to Trump, they can all live together. But you remove Trump, the unifying figure, and what do you have? You have the bag of scorpions. And they're going to fight each other. And I think that MAGA's ability to rip itself to shreds once Trump is sort of removed as a unifying figure is underestimated. And that you see the emergence of this in some of the fights online. Bomb Iran or not bomb Iran? Release the Epstein files or don't release the Epstein files? Both of these things are commentary on decisions Trump's made, but the actual anger is at each other. Is at each other, not at Trump. And so that tells me that in the future, things like Epstein, things like decisions about Iran, things like tariffs or taking an ownership stake in Intel, because Trump is doing them, that covers up the divisions. But once Trump is gone, that fighting, that infighting is just going to spill out all over the place.
All right, I lied. I have a few more questions. How do you explain the unifying, the almost miraculous / mystical unifying capacity of this man? I mean, so you're imagining that if Trump were to disappear and someone else would stand in his place, let's say J.D. Vance, he would not have the power to unify in the same way. What is it about Trump that unites people of all those different convictions?
Well, I think that people who, and I'm certainly one of them, who oppose Trump often underestimate that he has some unique talents. And one of the unique talents is that he does actually have a talent of kind of convincing each person that he talks to that he's with you and you're with him. You hear this all the time. Well, you know, I used to think X, Y, and Z, and then I met Trump and I talked to Trump. And always they go away thinking, he heard me. Like, that there's this capacity that he has to really make people think he's with them.
Right.
And when really you are with him. He's not with you. You're with him. And so I do think that he has this remarkable talent to convince people from all different kinds of walks of life that he's got their back. So that I think there's one thing that's very... The other thing that is that he is also very good at capitalizing on our distrust of institutions. So if you look at his coalition, the basic message was, if you're somebody who doesn't trust the establishment, whatever the establishment is, whether it's Big Pharma, whether it's the military-industrial complex, whatever it is,
the media,
whichever establishment you're angry at, I've got your back. I'm your home. So it's not just that he's taken one coalition of disaffected Americans. He's basically reached every coalition of disaffected Americans and said, if you're disaffected, I'm your guy. So these are two elements that are really shrewd about him that he's been able to, you know, really exploit, that he creates this impression that people are with him, that he's with people, and then he also has created a very shrewd big tent approach to building a coalition. So those are a couple of things. And then the third thing is, once you're in, Sam, the internal discipline is ruthless, ruthless. There are two ways forward. One is to continue to be in the warm embrace of MAGA and to enjoy all the bounties and benefits of that community and fellowship and access to power. But if you do deviate, if you do disagree, then it's the outer darkness, it's threats, it's loss of career, it's potential prosecution. I mean, there is a carrot and then there is a giant stick as well. So when you put all of these things together, what you have is an ability to create a coalition under him, because he's the architect of the carrot and he's the originator of the stick, under him that is cohesive and disciplined. However, you remove him and you have a lot of people running around trying to replicate his thuggishness. You have a lot of people running around trying to replicate his charisma, and nobody's got the whole package. And I think you're going to see Republicans experiencing a version of what Democrats experienced after Obama, what Republicans experienced in a previous era after Reagan, is that the person at the top of their coalition was a lot more important than they realized, and that the ideas that the person held were less important than the person. Mm. And I think that that's going to be true for Trump as well, that the person of Donald Trump was fundamental to MAGA, and that the ideas of MAGA have much less power than the person of Donald Trump.
Well, especially in the case, because the ideas seem to be in conflict with themselves. I mean, it just, there's not a coherent ideology coming out of Trump. He gets blown around by whatever whim has engulfed his brain. And, it's tariffs are on and tariffs are off, and both moves are a genius, you know, four-dimensional chess if you're a Trump fan. Well, so final question now, really final question. Is there anything you can imagine him doing or being discovered about him that would actually implode his support in Trumpistan? I mean, what could we hear him say on a tape? What conviction would be so antithetical to the cherished opinions of the Christian right or the America First base that it would just, that they would break with him? I mean, the thing that was interesting about the, at least the first weeks of the Epstein story, was that it seemed that there were people for whom Trump could do no wrong who suddenly said, okay, this is clearly bullshit. You're going to tell me that the Epstein scandal was concocted by President Obama and President Biden just to embarrass you and that there's nothing to see there? Okay, that's not going to wash. I mean, so people like Candace Owens or Tucker Carlson or, you know, people who had really been in lockstep with him, at least for much of the time, said, all right, this is now a line that we're not going to let you cross. What could he do as president that in the vein that we have described, I mean, the vindictive prosecution of enemies, what could he do that would just be so beyond the pale that everyone would recognize, all right, this is a horror show. We were wrong. We're now embarrassed that we ever supported the man. I mean, so to take, I'll give you one hypothetical. You know, he seemed, at least implicitly, threatened Bruce Springsteen when he criticized him on stage, wherever he was playing a concert and overseas somewhere. And Trump said, well, let's see what happens when he comes back to America, right? If Trump vindictively prosecuted Bruce Springsteen, and it was just clear that it was just pure authoritarian vengeance, you know, there was no merit to it at all, but yet he has successfully weaponized the DOJ to do his bidding, what percentage of Americans right of center would recognize, all right, this is no longer America?
1-2%? I mean,
is that bad? I mean, but is there anything you can think of that would matter?
I mean, I could imagine weird, fantastical, completely unrealistic scenarios like picking up a gun and shooting somebody on live television unprovoked. But if we're going to talk about in the realm of what's possible and realistic, nothing. And the reason why I say nothing is if you go back, that one of the most chilling charts I've ever seen is if you go back and you look at approval ratings amongst Republicans of three people, Mitch McConnell, Mike Pence, and Donald Trump, after January 6th. So this is where, if I had told your average Trump supporter in 2016, you know, the man you're electing is so bad that he will lie about the outcome of an election, try to fraudulently reverse it, and then eventually instigate a crowd descending upon the Capitol, violently attacking and temporarily seizing the Capitol of the United States to try to prevent a vote count, they would have said, you've got Trump derangement syndrome. No way he's that bad. No way he would do anything like that. Well, it all happened, right? And then after it happened, Mike Pence did what he had to do constitutionally. Mitch McConnell did what he had to do constitutionally. And look at approval ratings. Trump's approval rating, it dipped a little bit amongst Republicans after January 6th. Part of a slow, gradual slide that was reversed. But with Pence and McConnell, it was like their approval ratings fell off a cliff. Mm. Why? Because they defied Donald Trump and upheld the Constitution of the United States. And so what that tells me is in the world of realistic political alternatives, because I would have never even considered what Trump did to be a realistic political alternative, you know, earlier in his presidency. Mm-hmm. By the time 2020 rolled around, I was jumping up and down and yelling about potential violence. But in the world of realistic political alternatives, it is difficult for me to see anything that will separate him from his base, because you know what? They will always go back to the ultimate failsafe, which is no matter how bad Trump is, they're going to tell you the left is worse.
What if he tries to hold on to the presidency in 2028? What if he declares that he thinks elections are not going to be safe without much evidence, or some other stratagem? I don't know what Steve Bannon has been speaking confidently about the prospect of him running for a third term. I don't know what's cashing
mark
that out.
Mark my words. If he tries to do that, if he actually does go through with something like that, all of right-leaning media, Fox and all of the lesser satellites orbiting Fox, will lock in on the legal arguments why that has to happen, why it's such an emergency with the left will destroy America unless Trump runs again. I mean, you would see people fall into lockstep. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I really do not think I'm wrong. And there would be they would concoct a legal argument. Like, think about the January 6th stuff. The legal argument that John Eastman and others concocted to try to overturn this election was laugh out loud ridiculous, like failing law school level stupidity. But the median voter's not a lawyer, and you have somebody with a law degree saying, well, actually, the section blah, blah, blah of this, blah, blah, blah. And people are like, oh, I didn't know he can do this. Let's go. And so you would have a collection of MAGA scholars, you know, proposing why it's necessary. You would have a collection of MAGA voices talking about the unique threat to our democracy from the far left if Trump loses. You would have the whole menu of rationalizations being poured into this group that is then, remember, at all times being taught it's 6 minutes from midnight, and that if they lose just one more election, then America is over. And this is being poured into these folks. No, I think even if he tried to run for a third term, you would not see substantial degradation of MAGA support for him.
Well, ironically, it's sounding like 6 minutes from midnight, just in another vein.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, the interesting irony is that the conviction that the country is crashing is one of the things that's leading to the country being in peril. Yeah. Think of it like this. There was this essay called The Flight 93 election back in 2016.
Claremont Review.
Where we have to charge the cockpit or America's going to crash. Well, imagine you have a situation where you charge the cockpit, you choke the pilot to death, and you get behind the controls and you realize, oh, that was just turbulence. And we charged the cockpit over turbulence, and now nobody knows how to fly the plane. So your alarmism would create the very crisis that you're trying to avoid. And that is one of the things that's happening in this MAGAverse, is their alarmism about the United States of America, about their political opponents, is creating its own crisis.
All right, David, I can't say that I find any of this uplifting, but it's nonetheless a pleasure to get your voice back on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I do wish we had happier things to talk about.
Yeah, someday.
Someday.